The following is an audio recording of the impact of the word eternity. Collectively, these recordings form an audio history.
I think seeing the eternity word would have to be on the Harbour Bridge for the fireworks. But flashing back to the concept of it, I actually had an experience with my father where we would wander the streets around Bondi, and I was fascinated being pretty close to the ground, looking at people who'd scribbled in graffiti into the concrete, you know, just their name or something like that. I was always looking for some wet concrete to put my name in. And my dad said you didn't have to find wet concrete, you could just use chalk. And he told me a story about a man who spent a long time of his life writing chalk on the pavement. And he in fact had gone searching for that word. He'd seen the word many times. He'd gone searching for the man himself as a kid. So I don't think I quite understood the concept of eternity or could read the word, but the idea of looking for something scribbled on the pavement was something that I came along to at a young age, about 5 or 6. Born a long time later. But my father, he used to go out with his granddad. His granddad was a Methodist minister, and he knew Arthur. So in the mid-50s, I think around the time Arthur was kind of revealed to the public, my dad told me a story that he and his grandfather went out very early one morning in Ultimo, and they went searching to find the man, and all they could find was eternity written in chalk, and it looked like it was pretty fresh. So it was a bit of an Easter egg hunt in a way, searching for the guy who'd written it, and they were, you know, hot on his trail. And he used to see it a lot around the inner city suburbs and grew up with it. So more his generation than mine, but he passed that story on to me. Now, my grandfather's name was Reverend McKibben, and he was very influential around Balmain and Newtown, particularly over the Depression. He's a Methodist minister and a very social and public figure over the 1920s and 30s. As I say, I'm not sure how close their relationship was, but he certainly had met him. He certainly wanted to introduce my father to him. He was the sort of guy that when he went to the cricket, Don Bradman would nod his head because he had been, you know, the reverend at their sort of cricket sermon and spoken at someone's funeral. So, you know, that era of that generation of Australian men who were all looking out for each other, I suppose, over the Depression years. He was a public figure in that world. So Arthur Stace and he would have been in the same circles, I think. I first saw eternity on the bridge on the TV when I was down in Eden, south coast of Australia. I remember watching the fireworks and seeing that word light up was really special. And I think I remember wishing I was there in person because I'd seen most of the fireworks in Sydney, but that was our first time kind of visiting family friends down south.
Did you know what eternity on the bridge meant? Did you know the story?
You know what? I didn't connect the two dots, but I certainly knew of Arthur Stace's story and I recognised the word, but in that moment, I think I thought it had much more of a representation of the millennia starting. And I certainly didn't put it together with that historical meaning with Arthur Stace's story until a little bit later. The tour's called Slum Slashings and Sly Grog. An alternative name is Gangsters, Girls and Grog, but it covers an era where we have razor gangs, slums and grog being the term for liquor. So it's in that world of Surry Hills and Darlinghurst and all those things are sort of part of Arthur Stace's world, yeah. To give some context, we started with a convict tour in the Rocks and we became very interested in criminology, Sydney's underworld and figures from the past that are often forgotten. And my tour guide colleague wanted to bring to life Surry Hills, Darlinghurst, while I brought to life King's Cross. So we both wanted to focus on the same era, and I gave her some free rein to write a tour that incorporated the Tilly Devine, Kate Lee era of razor gangs and the underworld there, which Arthur Stace was involved with. So I have to give her a lot of credit for pushing his story into the tour. Her name's April Spears. And she, with me, basically thought that it was the right story to include in an underworld tour that was, you know, filled with notorious criminals that you sort of, their stories were pretty saucy and interesting to look at, but it needed someone who came good. And I think that's the real poignant part about Arthur Stace's story, whereas a lot of the criminals in the tour that we talk about in Surry Hills get shot or, you know, they're in and out of jail for the rest of their lives. He has that totally different story where he sort of emerges from the world that we bring to life in Surry Hills and takes on this whole new chapter of his life. So, yeah, we thought that was a really important thing to include in that tour. In so many of the stories we tell of Sydney's criminal underworld, you rarely have someone who totally changes their path in life. Quite interestingly, he actually has quite a similar story to figures from England who were convicts. They were thieves and they often, you know, committed a small crime. They were sent across to Australia, and it's when they arrived in Australia that they thought, well, perhaps I can start a new life. And some of them became very successful business people, and they sort of went from rags to riches. But you rarely have someone who was born into vice in Australia itself, doesn't sort of, you know, go to a whole new land and has the opportunity to start again. He had to sort of change his whole life within the muck of everything else that was going on around him. So, yeah, his story is really unique in that way, to pull himself out of it rather than being shipped off to another place and have to change your story because you're there. Well, we talk about it on the tour outside the Burton Street Tabernacle. And that is where, as you know, he had his moment of eternity after listening to a sermon there. And the idea of him walking out onto the street, having been so inspired by that word and its message, and basically seeing it as his opportunity to spread that word around the streets of Sydney himself and start to write it on the ground. Having that context on the tour, because we actually visit that spot, so you can imagine the moment that he had his sort of hallelujah, if you like, and walked out with eternity ringing through his mind and starting to put on the pavement. One, it fits into our context of the tour in the sort of world of that 1920s, 30s story in Surry Hills. And in terms of New South Wales, I suppose it represents a time in the middle of the Depression, a time when so many people were down and out. Sydney was really struggling to get by. And to have a word like that which represented hope, redemption, and to have it written in such beautiful writing on the very streets that were full of the other side of the coin, full of despair and poverty, I think it was a moment that maybe Sydney needed to really have a silver lining, an uplifting word to bring some joy to people in that poverty-stricken community. Yeah, look, people, I don't think, can imagine how bad it was. There are a lot of factors that contribute to places like Surry Hills and Darlinghurst being slums. A lot of it was to do with the Great Depression in the 1890s. So that's the first major depression. And that basically meant that a lot of the terrace housing, a lot of these grand Victorian mansions that were all in rows across the inner city suburbs, which were built for rich families who, you know, had multiple rooms and sometimes servants, they often sold them or they moved out and they rented them. And so the inner city started to change from being deluxe Victorian villas to places that were boarding houses. And a lot of these properties started to fall into disrepute and disrepair because the tenants didn't really want to do them up. They were just paying for the rent. So you start to see a world where councils don't have much money. All of the things that make a community tick, whether that's, you know, sewers and garbage and welfare starts to really fall apart. And around Surry Hills and Darlinghurst and Redfern, you started to see these once upon a time beautiful streets with their Victorian villas start to turn into slums. Now that gets hit even harder over the next couple of decades. You have the First World War, which, you know, takes so many working men away from their families. Many of them never return. So you have a lot of wives who have to turn to other means, sometimes prostitution, to get by. You had a criminal underworld which starts to emerge, especially after the World War, after the First World War. The First World War had quite a few effects. One of them was that men came back with all sorts of problems. Aside from being shell-shocked and often wounded, they came back with addictions. A lot of them were addicted to opiates through the morphine they'd been given. They'd picked up drug habits, alcoholism, and they often just didn't feel like they were fit to work and serve their family again. So they basically came back to Sydney unable to continue being the breadwinner. So we have a bit of a family breakdown over that era, and we start to see all sorts of women having to turn to the streets. We start to see a lot of people who you perhaps, you know, would never have turned to a life of crime start to enter into it. And throughout Surry Hills and Darlinghurst, we start to see all sorts of issues with prostitution turning off the streets and into illegal brothels. We also see sly grog, which was a term for selling liquor on the sly, which was another repercussion of the First World War, because there'd been an enormous soldiers' riot in 1916 in Sydney, which had been sort of Sydney's largest pub crawl ever. So thousands of soldiers had broken out from a camp in Liverpool. They'd commandeered a train to Central. They'd, you know, rampaged through the streets and drunk almost every hotel down George Street dry. They had to be rounded up by other defence force, and there was a shooting at Central Station. One of them was shot and killed. It was a huge fiasco, very embarrassing for the Australian public, because it basically meant that our diggers, our, you know, soldiers who were going to go off and fight the war, were disgracing themselves on home soil. So it was hushed up in the media. But one thing it did do was lead to a referendum that was pushed forward by the temperance movement. And the temperance movement was all about trying to, you know, rid alcohol from the community. But they used it to try and close the pubs early. So that meant that you had the 6 p.m. closing. That was pushed through in 1916. So if you're a drunk, if you came back from the war with alcohol problems, like a lot of these men did, then to get a drink after 6 p.m, you actually had to buy it illegally from a sly grog shop or a groggery. So you almost had to become a criminal just to feed your drinking habit. And that world of, behind closed doors, gambling halls, opium dens, brothels, two-up schools and groggeries was all through the Surry Hills, Darlinghurst area. So add that to slums and crime and no welfare, and, you know, you wouldn't recognise that time in Sydney today. He is right in the middle of it. He couldn't be more of a sort of product of that world. You know, he was born in 1885, so he was a kid when that first depression in the 1890s struck, and he was having to steal bread and milk from doorsteps as a, you know, 5 or 6 year old kid, encouraged by his alcoholic parents to do so. He then becomes a ward of the state, so, you know, he gets some welfare, but he has that sense of family breakdown. And he's a teenager when he turns to alcohol and becomes an alcoholic. He then gets sent off to the war, or he chooses to go off to the war, comes back with all sorts of health issues, and he's a drunk. And then he starts to become involved in petty crime. He was sort of on the fringes of the criminal underworld, connected to gangs. He worked as a cockatoo, which was a lookout for a two-up school, so illegal gambling school. He worked as a scout for his sister's brothel. So in every way, he is part of that underworld, that world of poverty and of degradation that those inner city suburbs were just rampant with. You know, if you wanted to tell the story of those suburbs, the first half of his life is really key to understanding how those city suburbs were functioning.
Subscribe below to find out more about the audio recordings and to be kept up to date when more are made available.